Welcome to China Manufacturing Decoded from Sofeast, the podcast where we take you through some of the major topics facing importers and manufacturers in China today. Hi listener, you're on board for episode 40 of the podcast. Adrian from Sofeast here, and I'm wishing you Xin Nian Kuai Le because it is Chinese New Year 2021. I'm joined by our CEO, Renault, and because it's Chinese New Year, if you do have suppliers in China or factories in China, you're probably going through a bit of a slowdown period, and that's going to last for a few weeks longer. So what can be done during this period of time? Well, it's a good time to think about how you can reduce risks in your supply chain and also uncover some untapped opportunities. And Renault is going to give you a really interesting checklist of activities and things that you can think about during this period of time when hopefully you've got a bit more time to devote the thought to it. So let's get into that.
Hi Renault, happy Chinese New Year.
Hey, thanks Adrian. Well, happy Chinese New Year to you too.
Yeah, year of the ox this year. It's supposed to be a very industrious year by all accounts.
Let's see. Yes.
Absolutely. So yeah, thanks for joining us, everybody. As you can probably tell, we're recording this on Chinese New Year's Eve. And as we head into Chinese New Year, a lot of people who are buying from China, perhaps you're a little bit less busy in some ways because your suppliers, no doubt, are not really active at the moment and are likely to be pretty quiet for a few weeks. So I got to talking with Renault and it's probably a good time to take a bit of a step back and to think about all of your operations and what you're doing in terms of risks and untapped opportunities as well, and try to look at how do we reduce the risks? What sort of opportunities do we have in the rest of 2021 and onwards? And Renault's going to introduce a bit of a checklist actually for us all. So without further ado, I guess, take it away.
Yeah, so basically, the idea is a lot of people who are very, very busy usually dealing with their Chinese suppliers have some time. So, you know, let them take a step back, let them think a little bit, you know, let's try to provoke some thinking around the risks of their situation, about, you know, maybe the opportunities that they might be missing on. So let's go through them, you know. Let's start, as usual, the bad stuff. You know, what about your current supplier base, and what, especially the key suppliers, what are the risks here associated with them, you know, on your company and indirectly on your customers, right? So some questions, you know, for example, are they all concentrated in the same country? You know, are they all concentrated? Even if, you know, let's say everybody's in China, let's say you have five key suppliers, they're all in China and they're all in Shenzhen, or they're all in Ningbo. You know, what does it tell you in terms of risk? As we saw less than a year ago, you know, if one place has some kind of issue, you know, maybe a serious epidemic, then everything might be closed there for a while. Yeah. That's a high risk. If they're spread out geographically, it's a lower risk. Now, obviously, having all the suppliers still in China in itself can be a risk, especially, I would say, if you sell a lot to countries that are not, you know, not very friendly to China these days, such as USA, Canada, Australia. You know, if these are big markets for you, and maybe UK soon, and maybe some others soon, you know, who, you know, obviously India, maybe also Japan, you know, all of these countries might be in some kind of conflict with China that might take over all the trade relationships with China. And then if you make a lot of products for these countries, and suddenly it's becoming very hard to work with these countries, well, to sell into these countries, that's going to be a serious issue, right? So that's a risk here, but at the same time, there might be an opportunity. Maybe there's a supplier somewhere in Thailand, in India, that might be able to make the same products without cost increases. Maybe, I don't know, if you sell mostly to Europe, maybe Eastern Europe might be cheaper, actually. And maybe you might have to redesign your product a little bit, make it easier to mass produce with higher automation. It might even be cheaper to make it in your country, right? So these are questions that should go through the minds of buyers, you know, regularly, and they should you know, check on the market. They should think. They should talk to people, because any improvement here can have very strong consequences for their business. There's other kinds of risks, obviously. For example, you keep buying one product that's really essential to your customer, to your you know, to your business or to your customer's business, and you only have one supplier making that product. Well, and maybe it is that customer's intellectual property, so maybe you cannot have a backup. But could you do something about it? Could you redevelop it with some differences so that you actually own that product, and you can have two suppliers maybe making it? You know, just to have more, you know, just lower risk and more options, basically, when things might become difficult, when disasters might strike, right? Otherwise, you're always at the mercy of, it could be an epidemic, it could be, you know, a tsunami, it could be an earthquake, it could be a serious trade war, it could be a currency that appreciates, you know, very, very strongly, and then your costs go up by 50% or something. And maybe your currency actually depreciates, so it's, you know, it's double whammy. So, you know, you might be stuck between the two blades of the scissor, and that's not good, right? So think about all these sort of macro risks by looking at your supplier base. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, it does. And I have a question about when you're talking about potentially moving some operations to other countries, perhaps, you know, sort of friendly countries in inverted commas. What if you're producing products which in all likelihood components or materials perhaps are coming from China, but you move your assembly to a different country, let's say Portugal or Turkey or wherever, but you're still using those Chinese components? I mean, is this kind of a workaround?
So there are pros and cons here. And yeah, a lot of people have been looking into this. Not many actually have really pulled the trigger. So on the you know, what is the benefit of this? If you make a substantial transformation, then let's say you assemble it in Portugal or in Poland, and you really substantially transform the product there. You know, you can say it's made in Portugal, right? And this gives you much better access to a number of markets. However, there's several issues here. You are making your supply chain more complex. So the components made for come from China, especially if there are custom components that are developed specifically for that kind of product. Well, when are you going to find out that they are defective, they are non-conforming? You know, if you ship it all to Portugal, and over there, as you put things together and you test it, you find that there are issues, ouch, that's a very, very serious problem. What are you going to do now? Send it all back to China? Defective products, you know, good luck with that. Not so simple, right? So you actually increase your risks you know, this specific category of risk actually goes up. And if the component suppliers in China are hit by some kind of disaster, same thing. You know, you're going to be unable to supply your customers. Same problem. Now, you might find that maybe the plastic enclosure can be sourced, you know, and made in Portugal, and that might make a lot of sense. So in that case, you you de-risk things as you localize it, you know, closer to your place of assembly. And if you have only one or two or three, four, five components that are standard that you buy from China, and you make sure that quality is all right and that the sources are very reliable, overall, it might make sense. It might really decrease your level of risk. It might also decrease your costs. So, you know, there's a lot of factors to take into consideration here. So that's why now is the good time to do that, because you don't have all kinds of pressing issues to respond to. You might try to put some numbers in Excel spreadsheet, you know, ask different suppliers here or there for quotations and think of, you know, what it would look like and what kind of risks come with it.
Okay, good. So what's next?
Okay, I said something bad, you know, negative. So now let's look into an opportunity with the supplier base or a few opportunities. Well, do you have too many suppliers? You know, so what happens with a lot of companies is that every time they need to buy a new product, they have their purchasers, you know, go out to the market and source, you know, the new supplier that already has something very similar, that is, you know, maybe the cheapest one, all factors taken into account, and so on and so forth. Maybe they are more of a specialist of that specific product. And then they end up with a lot of suppliers. And a lot of suppliers, that might actually come with a lot of hidden costs and a lot of inefficiencies and poor service. You spread your business across a number of suppliers. Obviously, you have less control over them, less weight over each of them. So you get actually lower, you know, worse service. Maybe also you're not really capturing all the savings that you could. And on the other hand, if you try to concentrate your supplier base into fewer suppliers, at least in some of the product categories you're purchasing, well, you might be able to, you know, pump up the volume, as they said in IKEA, and push the prices down, and at the same time have more influence over these suppliers. And also, when you have fewer suppliers that are already key suppliers, there's much more of a sense of we're in this boat together, you know, long-term partners, and let's work a little bit more hand in hand, you know. Let's try to provide some. Let's try to explore some opportunities together, basically. One example of opportunity that can open up is maybe co-development of some products. So you have a supplier that has a real R&D capability that's really interesting for you, and you think that, because of, you know, where your market is going, this is going to be something really that you really need. Well, then give them more business, become, you know, one of their long-term customers that they can count on, and you'll be able to tap into their R&D capabilities. That's an example here. Another example might be, again, like IKEA has done very well in some cases, is send a team of engineers there and actually, is, you know, look at their manufacturing practices, their purchasing and planning practices, and so on, and give them a lot of advice on how to cut their costs while improving their quality, just by looking at their systems and processes and giving them some ideas about how to set that up better, right? And in among retailers, IKEA is probably the only one really doing that well. Maybe in garments, there might be a few like Marks and Spencer and so on, but less so, not to the same extent. However, when you look at brands that are really specialized in a certain kind of product or certain vertical, it is more common that they would send people there and sort of teach the suppliers some good practices, or send some engineers, some consultants to do that. I mean, number of clients of CMC, China Manufacturing Consultants, mm-hmm. have done that, right? Mm. So this is a way to, you know, improve the processes and the systems. And as you do that, you ensure that your key suppliers will survive, you reduce their costs, you improve their quality. Now, of course, some of your direct or indirect competitors, if they also buy from that same factory, will benefit. Now, that's for sure. You probably don't want to have your direct competitor buying from the same supplier. I mean, you know, another reason of having key suppliers and tighter partnerships with these key suppliers is that you lock your direct competitors out of that that source. You know, they cannot go there and pick things up, right? Well, also, you know, during Chinese New Year, think about the performance of your suppliers over the past year. You know, in terms of quality, you know, how many disasters have you had, or semi disasters? How many late deliveries? You know, how many cost increases that don't really make sense, right? And also think about the service that they give you. You know, how fast they respond to you. If you develop new products with them, how, you know, do they really contribute nicely? Do they have some good capabilities in terms of product engineering and process engineering, right? So try to grade your suppliers more or less about that. And, you know, in the 90s, GE was, I mean, they became, I think, the most valuable company on the planet, and everybody was looking at their management practices. And one thing that a lot of people were talking about was that rank and yank sort of approach to employee management, where each manager would supposedly have to pick, I think it was 10%, maybe 20%, I'm not sure, at least 10% of the team members and fire them, just to force some turnover in the team and weed the weakest elements out. Now, in practice, it was never really done that way, from what I read. But anyway, that's besides the point. You know, some turnover is a good thing. If you're stuck with the same long-term suppliers, the problem is, you know, are you getting good performance? If you're not getting good performance, you get to force some turnover in your supplier base. You gotta kick one out, and maybe not tomorrow, but you get to start developing a backup. And if the backup actually is doing a good job, well, this should become the primary supplier of that product. It's often a little bit difficult to have these types of conversations with your Chinese suppliers, because if they feel that you might go away, then they might become nervous and they might start to do some very unethical things. So a lot of people don't really dare to bring that up. And, you know, some people are just trying to be nice. That's great. That's respectable. But in the long run, this is really hurting your business and your customers' business. Right. And, you know, at one point, you have to decide Do you want to protect your suppliers? Do you want to protect your employees and their families? You know, do you want to protect your customers and make them happy? You know, what is the most important? Because actually you are making a choice. And if you're not kicking a supplier out when their performance is bad, you know, and if obviously if there's they have a sort of a history of not really improving, right? You are actually making a choice of prioritizing them over your employees and your customers.
But in fact, a lot of importers, and I mean, you've written a few times about this recently over on qualityinspection.org about when to consider switching to a new supplier and why a lot of importers don't choose to do it, even if their current supplier is not doing well for numerous different reasons. So with that being said, what is the reason why so many importers still just hang on to these maybe substandard suppliers and retain this damaging status quo?
Well, they might wonder, there's a lot of situations, but a few that come to my mind is maybe they're thinking, hey, what are they going to do? You know, I'm not going to be able to pull the molds out, you know, if there's some tooling, for example. So they're just going to produce it for my direct competitors, or maybe they're going to start to sell it themselves, maybe on Amazon or something. You know, it's my product, but they won't care. Or they know who is my biggest customer, and they're going to go to them directly. You know, so this is one fear, and that would lead me to the next point. And there's some other reasons, right? You know, some people really believe, you know, they really tied, how to say, they set up some friendly ties with the suppliers, and they really think of the supplier's boss maybe of as one of their long-term partners, and yeah, they made so many efforts. Oh, you know, we've been working together for 15 years. You know, they we grew up together and things like that, and they're a little bit romantic about that, which I mean is not a bad thing. So, whatever the reason, right? Or maybe you think you have a great price, or you think that you can really pull some special favors out of them or something, and that you cannot do it with a new one, or you know, maybe you're just comfortable with them. So there's a number of reasons, and it's really going deep into the psychology of some people. I'm not sure I get things right. But a lot of these things have to do with the absence of legal agreements around the development of products and around the manufacturing, right? If you're afraid that once you no longer buy from them, they're going to sell your products to your competitors, or they're going to set up a store on Amazon selling your products or something like that, well, that, you know, what does that mean? Actually, to me, it screams, we never actually sat down and signed, you know, legally enforceable agreements.
Yeah.
So we're doing everything sort of, you know, we're deciding on things as the circumstances come up. And that is a bit scary. But some people are more comfortable with that. You know, it does require an uncomfortable situation, uncomfortable conversation, definitely. And if you haven't done it at the very beginning, you know, it might be too late, because the supplier might say, oh no, come on, we've been doing business in friendly terms, you know, you're kind of insulting me and blah blah blah. Or maybe they say, oh, it's a long document, I'm not sure, I will talk to my lawyer, and then they make it last forever, right? So if you haven't done it at the beginning, it might be impossible to set it up. If you can, maybe you have to invoke some kind of reasoning, such as, hey, we have a new investor, and they, you know, they really help us develop sales a lot, but they say they will not do it because we don't have this kind of agreement. So come on, help me, let's sign it, you know. this is an example, right?
And that's an important proviso, because if you have a relevant and legal manufacturing agreement that is enforceable in China, switching suppliers, if you find that your current supplier is not fulfilling, you know, what they're expected to, for example, shouldn't necessarily be that nerve-wracking of a process. Mm-hmm. But if you're not protected, that's when, of course, the worry kicks in, and it could become really, really difficult. And I suppose this sort of period of time during Chinese New Year is really the right time to be thinking about this and assessing whether you are in either of those situations.
Yes. And so what can you do now about it? Let's say you have a current supplier base, and I don't know, you have 10 suppliers. You think that, you know, two or three of them will sign it. The other ones are going to be much harder to convince. You know, you got to have a plan to try, but also more importantly, you have to think, what is my onboarding process going to be for the next suppliers? You know, next time we get another supplier on board, what is the onboarding process? And similarly, with the current suppliers, if we give them a new product to make, you know, well, that's, you know, that might be a good option, because here's something, you know, here's the carrot, you know, here's the business coming your way. But for this, you know, for this and this reason, you know, maybe it's going to be sold to a buyer that forces us to do this and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, we can give you that extra business, but only if you will sign that. Mm. So think of what you can do in the future. You can't solve all your problems right now. However, you need to set better processes in place so that in 5 years, you're in a much better position, right? Mm. Thinking of these agreements, yeah. So also one thing very important is, don't just take a template that you find on the internet. I mean, I found some funny ones and some crazy ones also. What you need to make sure of is, if you are buying from China, if your supplier in China, for example, you need to make sure your contracts are enforceable in China. And there's a number of countries, such as the USA, that that have sort of a problem. Even if you, so you, let's say you call for litigation in New York City and you sue the supplier there and you win, well, a Chinese court of justice is not going to enforce it. So it's actually not enforceable. You just spent a lot of money for nothing, something that's going to be totally useless, right? So make it China-centric, as they say. And there's a lot of articles on, you know, about that on the China Law blog. Dan Harris and Steve Dickinson wrote a lot about that. And same idea in Vietnam, in India, and so on. You know, can you actually enforce the contract? Otherwise, you know, it's... And the suppliers, more and more suppliers are savvy about that. They know, you know, if you go with a supplier and you tell them, hey, you have to sign this NDA with blah, 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 $1 million of damages, and if anything leaks and blah, 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 and they look at it and they see, oh, you know, a court in Los Angeles. Yeah, yeah, okay, no problem. Yeah, I have no assets in the US, so... And this is basically going to be useless. No problem, I'll sign it, right? I will chop, I will do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. So more and more suppliers know about that, and they know a little bit about their risks. And this also brings me to the next topic, is transparency in the supply chain. Okay. Well, do you buy from companies that just, you know, do the final assembly, but are actually not creating much value, and you keep buying from them because they have, you know, access to that source of that, whatever, if it's maybe the finishing of the product, you know, and the plating. Oh yeah, the plating is done really nice, consistently in the same color. That's exactly what we want. it's really hard to find another good plating provider for these kinds of volume and that price, you know. Then that's why we keep buying from this company ABC. Company ABC just does the final assembly and the packing, actually not bringing any value to the process, but just because they get the, you know, the plating supplier right, we keep working with them.
Mm.
Well, this is like a trading company, right? So 10 or 20 years ago, a lot of buyers said, hey, stop. We stop buying from trading companies. They don't really bring any value. And we want to see who's making our products. Okay, so a lot of buyers went direct to the factory, right? That was a big, big trend. And now a lot of them are finding that they're still working with an intermediary that's bringing little value, if any value, and maybe they're causing more problems than they're solving, is the final assembler, right? And if the final assembler is not transparent about where they buy from, you are renting their supply chain. You're not really setting up and owning your supply chain, right? So if you say this is my product and I own all the IP rights and everything, yeah, but I don't know where the components come from. I don't know where the surface treatments are done. Hmm. Is it really your product? That's a question worth pondering, you know? So obviously, if you did not pay for the sourcing, if you did not pay anything for that, and if the supplier did all the hard work, you can't force them to reveal their sources, right? Because that's sort of the unwritten agreement that you had with them. However, are there ways for you to know about some good sources? Maybe you need to qualify some of the good sources yourself, and, you know, together with a backup supplier, and set up a parallel supply chain that you control. And maybe you can push your current supplier to reveal these sources. I mean, I've seen buyers that succeeded in doing so. And it's the same idea as forcing them to sign a legal agreement. You know, my boss says, we have to do it. You know, you have to help me. Come on, please. You know, oh, this new investor, this new customer, blah, 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 right? This new regulation forces us to do that. And in some cases, it works.
Mm.
In some cases, it works. So all of that was on the supply chain side. Another thing that might make sense, if you have designed your own products, how durable are they, right? What is their quality? Maybe you need to redesign them with better durability in mind. You know, maybe you need to redesign them so that the manufacturing processes are easier and less prone to quality issues. And then once they're in the field, they are more likely to keep working for longer in the conditions of use that they are subjected to, right? You know, do you need to do that? Yes or no? And this is something that a lot of companies plan for their next version. Oh, yeah, when we get to version 3, we have to do this, we have to do that. Okay, so what exactly are the failures that you are observing with the current version? What can you do about it? Maybe you just need to redesign the process a little bit, not the product. Or maybe you just need to change this secondary material that will not, maybe you have a ferrous alloy, you know, made with an iron basis, and it, mm-hmm. and it has to withstand a lot of mechanical pressure and shocks, and after a while, ferrous alloys, you know, have some kind of fatigue effect, and then they break much more easily after a certain point. Well, maybe you need to change that alloy to another kind of alloy that doesn't have the same fatigue effect, you know, and maybe it has zero impact on maybe the customers will never notice it. Maybe price will be lower, you know, maybe you reduce your cost at the same time, but definitely you will improve the reliability of your product, right?
Mm.
You will keep it working for longer in the field or in the hands of your customers. Is this something you need to do, right? So that's an example. And that leads me to the next point is, do you actually have data that you collect in a structured manner about quality issues, about returns, you know, and complaints and so on about your customers? And the quality issues that you yourself notice when you maybe you receive the products or you check them in your supplier's factory. Do you try to have a database with all this, and do you try to organize it nicely for analysis to see some trends, to see what the biggest sources of problems are and so on? And then you know, do you do some failure analysis to really understand where it comes from, right? If not, how do you expect to improve, right?
Right.
And maybe this is costing you an arm and a leg. This can be extremely expensive, especially if you consider the loss of customers. You know, customers who stop buying from you, that in the end, that's the most expensive sometimes.
Mm. And I suppose, because you've got this data coming in from your manufacturers, from assembly, from customers, once it's in customers' hands, this is perhaps one of the things that gets put on the back burner for many importers, many brands, because right, they're just so busy usually.
Yes, exactly. And then, and they have, you know, different data coming from different sources, different parts of the company handling these different data, and it's never really recouped and analyzed. Mm. Very big missed opportunity here.
Mm.
Well, we should maybe also cover new product development. If you regularly develop new products, do you have a structured process in place to follow, right? So especially if you're going to make this product in large quantities, you need to invest more time to double check and validate, you know, that the product design, the process design, the measurement system and so on are going to lead to the right results or not, right? If you're curious about that, you can Google new product introduction process, NPI process, and we have a long page about that. But really the key idea is, if you let the supplier, if you let a factory go into mass production with, you know, straight from, this is the design, okay, this prototype looks good, let's approve it, and let's just, you know, buy the parts, put it together, ship out, put it in the stores, or ship it to customer, to maybe an end customers. The risks that things go wrong are high. And the more complex, the more new the product is, the higher the risks. I mean, if it's really a new and complex product and you do that, you are going to have problems. There's just no way that things are going to go nicely, right? And on the other extreme, companies like Apple, companies like Ford, you know, for cars, or Toyota, Nissan, and so on, they have a very, very, very structured process. They do a lot of extra engineering work to reduce these risks. So that's the idea. If you don't have any process in place, maybe that's why you are suffering from a lot of bad surprises in production, right? Your local teams, do you have people on the ground working for you? Maybe, you know, in Ho Chi Minh City, in Guangzhou, in Shanghai, do you have your own staff? Well, what about the staff doing the sourcing? Are they working hard enough to find new sources, for example, new suppliers? Or are they just comfortable working with the current suppliers? What could you do to get people a little bit hungrier for new sources? If you have your own inspection team, for example, when you include the cost of the manager or the assistant manager, the supervisors, and so on, is it actually costing you more than outsourcing that, right? This is something that you should ask yourself, because over time costs might balloon and, you know, things might drift without control. And that is a big problem. Also, are they working smarter, or are they just working the same way as 5-10 years ago, right? Do they have the right kind of app to input the results very fast and cut the paperwork and so on, or not? So this is something we see a lot of potential for, right? And since we've equipped our inspectors with a mobile app, we can see a lot of at the same time better efficiencies, but also at the same time more control. We can see what they do. We can see when we have a doubt, we can go back and see how many hours did they work on that inspection, for example. What did they do, in what order, and so on. If you don't know that, well, maybe you're taking excessive risks. Inventory management. How do you decide how much inventory to have per type of product? Maybe it needs to be related to the risk of each individual supplier. Maybe you need to collect some data. And we wrote about that, I don't remember, maybe 6 months ago, in a blog post about supply chain risk management. Maybe we can link to it. About inventory management. But there are ways to collect data actually to make better decisions on how much inventory to hold. Another one, obviously, are you just using Excel, you know, Excel spreadsheets and emails to manage everything in your business? Are you, you know, do you have an ERP at least to manage the key numbers? But is it actually supporting the work of the people? Is it helping with collaboration or not, right? Maybe it's time to ask some questions and look at what other companies are using, right? We could keep going on and on, but I think this is already a solid list to prompt people to ask themselves some tough questions.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially a great list to follow if you're trying to spring clean your operations and really find those risks that you can squash or opportunities, as you said at the top of the episode, you know, untapped opportunities that could bring benefits later on in the year and moving onwards. So yeah, that's very, very interesting. Now, during the episode, I mean, you've mentioned a ton of different topics. Pretty much you've written on these over the years on Sofeast or qualityinspection.org. So if you are listening and you're interested in learning more about each of the points, I will add a bunch of links to the show notes as well, to the different blog posts and whatnot that could be helpful.
Great.
Well, I will leave you to continue your Chinese New Year celebration, Renaud, and to everybody else listening, Gong Hei Fat Choi.
Yep. See you in quite a
Right. So yeah, thanks for joining me, Renaud, and thanks everybody for listening.
Yep, have a good one.
Thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, don't forget to like and share, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other places that you get your podcasts from. See you next time.